This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're going to talk about youth sports. So let's start with a former youth and a continuing athlete. Her name is Jennifer Howell, and she joins us from Denver, Colorado. Jennifer, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you for having me, Meghna.
I hope you didn't mind that I called you a former youth.
I'd like to think I have a little bit of youth left.
Well, let's say definitely you still youthful. That's what I'm gonna put. So tell me, you have played sports for a long time. What was the sort of the earliest you got involved in athletics?
Yeah. So I think I was around five or so. My parents put me in just kind of like your community recreational soccer league. So I remember doing that for a little bit. I'm sure parents now are thinking of their kids with the, you know, soccer ball as high as their knees and not a lot going on. And then a couple years after that, around 2000, I think like my parents were talking to other parents and one of them suggested like, hey, like Jennifer's really good. You should consider putting her in a club sport, you know, the local club team. And you know, they travel, they do tournaments, and it's essentially the first step onto you know, maybe playing soccer in college or continuing on to like national team, Olympics, all that
wow.
fun stuff.
Okay. And yep. It sounds like you were about maybe eight or nine at the time.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. You know, what's interesting, first of all, when you said you got involved at age four or five in kind of a rec league, I used to referee for the young kids at AYSO, and it's a delightful time to watch children play, right? Because, like, the balls are as high as their knees, and, like, everybody crowds around the ball, and it's kind of like a school of fish moving across the field. You can't really see the soccer ball.
Yep.
So it's just wonderful. It's actually quite both intense in a kid version and really joyful. So how, at that age, when you first got started and a couple of years in, I mean, how did you feel as a 6 or 7 year old playing?
I mean, I think I liked it. you know, that was only a couple of years ago for me, definitely. So I do remember having fun, you know, especially you have like all your fun little pizza parties and everything after. And I think where it started to shift just a little bit was you're trying to figure out who the goalkeeper of the team is going to be. Mm-hmm. And the story that I was told several times was I took a ball to the face and didn't cry. And everyone was like, yes, goalkeeper.
Oh, wow.
That is the goalkeeper.
The wall is what we used to call our keeper, the wall. but the keeper is also a real leader on the team, right? Because she's giving a lot of directions for how, you know, where especially the defensive line should stand and move, et cetera. So I'm presuming you were made the keeper of your team. And did you enjoy that role as well?
I enjoyed the technical aspects.
Okay.
The leadership portion was the most challenging for me because I at some point I was an extroverted child, and then I definitely became a lot more introverted. So it was very difficult for me to be yelling, and especially as you know, kind of age, hit that middle school time frame where you know emotions are shifting at the drop of a pen, and. So then, you know, you're in a game and then it's like, oh, well, I don't like the way she yelled at me. So it definitely was a bit dicey.
Yeah.
In terms of maintaining friendships off the field, on the fields, especially, and sometimes you're a little bit spiteful where it's like, well, she didn't pass me the ball. So I'm not going to pass her the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of factors at play.
So, but I'm presuming that you did join the travel team.
Yes. Yep. So I did that for, I think around 2000 to, I'm not quite sure what year I quit, but it would have been around 2008, maybe, somewhere in there. I was with the same team for quite a while. And then at some point it folded and I'm not quite sure what the details were. And so then we started traveling to an adjacent city that was about an hour away.
Mm-hmm.
And then not sure why we switched again, but we ended up driving to Tallahassee, which was about an hour and a half to 2 hours for a one-way trip for a practice.
Wow. Okay. So then you're talking about, I guess, 4 hours out of your day just in transportation.
Yep. Yep. And in the on season, that was about twice a week. So during high school, I was in the IB program and was taking AP electives, on track to become valedictorian, and was doing a, you know, 4 hour round trip twice a week for practice. Huh. And that didn't include tournaments on the weekends. So that was my entire life, was school, practice, homework, tournaments. Well, and that was it.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm sure it won't come as a surprise to you, Jennifer, that some people are hearing this saying, good for her. You know, she was a really focused, accomplished, talented young woman whose high school career would be the envy of a lot of other kids. You know, I get it. It's a huge time commitment. But like I said, in just hearing kind of like the resume version of what you experienced, it was really impressive. But what was going on with you then during that time? Because I also understand you were like attending college sports camps. Were you even sort of in pre-recruitment processes with colleges, which all sounds good too, but what was happening with you internally during this time?
Oh yeah. Internal Jennifer was not having a good time. So just the stress from having to keep up with homework, studying for tests, making sure, you know, the GPA wasn't slipping, but also making sure that I was making that resume as nice as possible for college. And you know, the way kind of everybody frames it is, if you play for D1, you don't have to pay for college, you're on a full ride, you know, don't have to worry about that, you know, those pesky student loans. And so it became very, very pressured. It was a very a difficult situation. And so, you know, it got to the point where I was developing a lot of anxiety, became very depressed. And so I'd say from the time that I was about maybe 13 or 14, I learned what panic attacks were. Mm. So, you know, maybe for an upcoming tournament, the night before, you know, might not be able to sleep. If I made mistakes during the game, it would send me spiraling mentally, because then it became what if there was a college recruiter at this game? I made a mistake. I'm the goalkeeper. Mistakes are pretty obvious. The casual viewer can pick it up, because the goalkeeper makes a mistake, it's almost an automatic goal.
Yeah, I had to get past 10 other people first, though, I just want to say.
It did, yes. And that was a very, very common, it's like, oh, well, it did have to get past 10 other people. And it's like, well, yes, but also, it's really hard not to take that, a goal personally.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the words were there, almost like as a platitude, but it never was like, hey, you know, we're going to really dig into this and make sure that you're actually doing okay. And so it's, just wasn't a really good time. Mm-hmm. I was dreading practices. I was dreading tournaments, games, just a lot of anxiety in my life at that point.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to get out of it, because that was all I knew.
It was your whole identity.
Yeah. That was it. If you asked anybody who, you know, knew me, it was just like, oh yeah, Jennifer, she does soccer. Mm. There was nothing really else going on. Not like, oh, she loves Harry Potter or anything like that. It was just, yes, soccer. And that is it.
Well, I understand though that you did stop playing before you graduated from high school. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. So I reached a point. It was, one of those weeks where I think it was just a lot going on academically. And then we were on the way back from practice, you know, in the dark, like try to do homework by flashlight, because this was before you could just have a, you know, laptop and do all of your homework on your laptop. And I just remember thinking, like, I'm really not happy. You know, at this point in my life, like there's not really anything redeeming to me. And so, you know, just in the car ride home, you know, I said, like, I don't want to do this anymore. And my mom did not take that well. And, you know, at that point, that was also her entire identity, was like, I am the soccer mom. Yeah. There's absolutely nothing else. And, you know, she ended up calling all the relative people, or, you know, the pertinent people that needed to know. So like my coaches, my dad, and just kind of was like, oh, well, Jennifer decided to do a 180 and, you know, ruin her life. So it was a very long car ride home.
You were hearing all these phone calls.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was in the car at the same time.
How did it change your relationship with your mother over the next year?
So she didn't talk to me for about a month.
It's okay.
And we basically never talked about it again. So, you know, there wasn't anything like, you know, well, why do you want to do it? Or, you know, is there a reason? It was just like an immediate, like, you have ruined your life, and therefore, you know, thereby ruining mine. And so, you know, it just, yeah.
Jennifer, can you stick with us for a few more minutes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so we're going to take a quick break, and we'll talk more about youth sports when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about youth sports and the pressures these days that come along with it. To be frank, this is not new. This has been going on for a long time, but we're talking about how youth sports has changed so radically because it doesn't seem to be moving away from that trajectory. It's still happening, and perhaps with ever more intensity as parental fears about college rise with every additional year. So we're going to talk more about that in a minute. But we've been listening to Jennifer Howell in Denver, Colorado, share her story with us. And first of all, Jennifer, I just want to say thank you again for trusting us, because I know that it can't be easy for you to talk about difficult things that kind of caused a rift between you and your parents. So I really feel that. And I wanted to say thank you for trusting us. So what, just briefly tell me, like, what happened after that? What did college look like? What does your life look like now? Did it get ruined by that decision you made in the back of the car with the flashlight over your homework?
Oh, yeah, terribly ruined. I definitely much, much happier now. Really, my relationship with my parents is definitely not close. It's kind of like we maintain like a, you know, check in, like, hey, like, I'm not dead. our fence blew down a couple of weeks ago. Like, you know, just very minor communications like that. So it definitely caused the rift, but part of that was just really feeling like a prop or like a trophy, essentially, you know, for my mom to kind of show off and say, you know, look at this shiny child that I have. And so through, you know, quite a bit of therapy, a lot of therapy, you know, and through my college years, I branched out. I, you know, started doing things other than soccer. I actually ended up playing Quidditch in college.
Wow.
Shout out to all my friends from the Quidditch team. moved out to Denver afterwards. Ended up playing a little bit of Gaelic football and some Australian rules football. And ended up getting my master's in biomechanical engineering.
Oh,
and
wow.
Now I'm working at a medical device company doing hardware testing.
Not too shabby.
So,
yeah. If I say so myself.
And you know, my husband would be a little bit remiss if I didn't mention that, you know, I married a wonderful man. he's going to listen to it later and be like, why didn't you mention me?
you got your shout out there, Jennifer's husband, much deserved.
Yes.
So, you know, Jennifer, I can't, of course, say that I understand or know specifically what was going on in your parents' head, specifically your mother's head. So I'm not going to make any claim to that. But I also, I'm also reluctant to demonize parents in general. Because from my POV now as a mother myself, it's really complicated, right? Because, right? Like you love your children more than anything else. And you want to see them love something that they're doing in their lives and really blossom and succeed. And especially if they have some talent in it, you know, there's always this give and take, like, okay, how much should I encourage them? How much should I like help, clear the path forward for them? And, you know, could this talent also help with other things later in life? Some parents might go overboard, but I would say that it's really complicated on the parental side of things. So I'm wondering, now that you're older, how do you think about that?
Oh yeah, you know, as an adult and having to, you know, manage my own household and work and taxes, you know, all the fun things that come with growing up, I can't imagine having children on top of that. I mean, it's difficult. It's a difficult job. And, you know, part of what I would just say is, you know, make sure that your children aren't your entire identity.
Mm-hmm.
It puts a lot of pressure, you know, whether you, you know, explicitly say that to your kids or not. Because I'm sure, like, it feels great to be like, you know, to have your parents be like, oh, you're in my entire world. But also there's kind of that like little bit of a dark underside to it where it's like, oh, well, if I'm the entire world, what happens if I mess up? What happens if I don't meet expectations? Like, does my mom or my dad's entire world crumble because of that? So I think it's, you know, making sure that you also have something else, you know, and, you know, that's, Your child isn't your everything, which it kind of sounds weird saying that out loud. but also just you know, like making sure like your kids still having, like your kids still being a kid. Because it shouldn't be a job at that point. And, you know, checking in like, hey, are you still having fun? Is this something that you still want to do? And then, if your kid wants to go on to the Olympics or, you know, whatever level they're aspiring to be, just be like, hey, you know, in order to do this really awesome thing at the end, here's kind of what you're going to have to go through to get there. Do all of these sounds cool with you? Like, dude, is this something that you want to do? Because it's one thing to say like, I want to win a gold medal, but you don't just go out and win a gold medal.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work in between.
Yeah. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on the show and for sharing your story with us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me.
That's Jennifer Howell. She joins us from Denver, Colorado. So when we told you, On Point listeners, that we were going to do an hour, or are doing an hour, on youth sports, we got a ton of responses. This is something that touches a lot of families across the country. For example, here's AJ Pesta, who's been a youth basketball referee in upstate New York for more than a decade. And he says Specialization, and that's really what we're talking about, specialization like Jennifer did at a very young age, is putting too much pressure on the young athletes he referees.
The pressure is just immense. And what compounds that is now these tournaments are costing big money. And there are those who see it as a way to build skill and improve. And I think it's being taken advantage of. You know, with specialization comes the sacrifice of joy for any of this sport.
Here's listener Jordan Lewis from Salt Lake City, Utah. And he said for his family, the high cost of youth sports is actually well worth it. Jordan has two kids. They climb competitively, which means more than $800 per month in gym fees.
But it is the greatest thing that has ever happened to my kid. My son is really shy, and when he goes into the gym, he has this community. He's able to open up and talk to people, which is something that he couldn't have done a few years ago. And in climbing, you get to compete against yourself. So it's all kids rooting for each other, and it's a really great community. It's been just the greatest thing in the world for my kids. I'd spend any amount of money for them to be able to have that in their lives.
So there Jordan's talking about all the other things that come along with being dedicated to a particular sport. Well, joining us now is Tom Ferry. He's executive director of the Aspen Institute's Sports and Society Program, founder of Project Play, and author of Game On, the All-American Race to Make Champions of Our Children. Tom, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Magda.
So, you know what? Again, I don't want to spend the whole hour beating up on parents, but we will come back to parenting a little bit later in the show. What I want to hear from you is that there is an entire youth sports economy, right, that's kind of grown up around these trends in youth sports. How would you describe how big that economy is and how pervasive it is?
Well, based upon our research, just prior to the pandemic, so it's probably the numbers are probably larger now. parents alone spend north of $30 billion a year on youth sports. So to put that in perspective, the NFL is the money flowing through the NFL is a lot smaller. You know, so the youth sport economy is bigger than any sport economy that we have in our society. And it's money that's attached to a lot of emotion. You know, I like to say that when you have a child, your favorite athlete is no longer LeBron James or Steph Curry or whoever. It's that child down the hallway. That's the one you have the emotional investment in. That's the one you want to advocate for. That's the person you talk about at cocktail parties or backyard barbecues or whatever else it may be. So it's an enormous institution, and stories like Jennifer's just make me sad. And unfortunately, they happen every day.
Okay, so are we talking about, or let's understand more of the forces that have led to this $30 billion business, for lack of a better word.
Yeah,
is it specialization, this trend towards specialization that we've been talking about kids at younger and younger years, not just getting started playing, but then just deciding, or well, maybe they don't decide, but their families and them end up being locked into one sport. Is that what's driving it? Or are there other factors that we should also take into account?
Yeah, there's no one. That's why it took me 284 pages of the book. There's no one reason how this all came together.
I'm going to ask you to summarize it in 30 seconds, but go ahead.
Yeah, bottom line is the incentives for athletic performance at an early age have grown significantly since the 1990s. In the early 1990s, there was about $200, $300 million a year that was distributed for NCAA athletic scholarships, Division I, Division II. Today, that's north of $3.6 billion. And that is what has driven the creation of these early forming travel teams, which leads to the early specialization and the year-round play and the high doses of training and the type of unfortunate experiences that we heard from Jennifer.
Wow. Okay. So I just still want to what shifted in the 90s specifically?
Title IX, got enforced. I mean, it was not enforced really for the first 10, 15 years after it was signed by Richard Nixon in the early 1970s. The court started enforcing it. Much more money parents started to wake up to the idea that if, you know, if I invest in my daughter through sports, then they might be able to receive a scholarship and they might be able to receive preferential admission to selective universities. That's a big driver as well. How do I get my kid into the Ivies? How do I get my kid into Babson? Places like that. And so parents are willing to write the checks.
Mm. Okay, so I received an email from a listener about exactly this point. And this listener was quite concerned that this would end up being an hour of just, you know, blaming parents for driving their children to distraction through sports specialization and unrealistic hopes and dreams. But this parent said, quote, "I think all the finger pointing at sports parents is missing an important point." And this gets to what you're saying, Tom. For, quote, "overrepresented majority girls specifically," and my guess is she's saying, you know, probably white young girls, even those with strong academics, sports have become the only entry to selective colleges, including D3 schools, unless your parent is wealthy or an influential politician. The listener said, "I would never have believed the extent to which this is true until my own children experienced it. Intense sports is a soul-crushing, enormous financial sacrifice and a killer of family time. But sadly, for many parents, it is also the best investment you can make in your child's educational future." So are you saying this listener is wrong, Tom?
No, they're right and they're wrong, right? They're right in that there are... If you are a recruited athlete, and look, my son was. My son got into Babson because he was a recruited soccer athlete. The coach went to the admissions department. He was a good student and, you know, ended up being an honors student and has done very well in his post-college life. But, like, soccer absolutely got him into a selective college. And parents know this. Parents know this. And so they're willing to invest. It's the unfortunately, what happens is along the way, it becomes all about the return on investment. And you lose the real reason why you want your kids playing sports, which is for health, which is for human development, which is for, you know, being can be very good in terms of protective for mental health, problems. So, you know, we forget that, like, sports is meant to be about joy of game, the development of physical literacy, lifelong habits of fitness. But once parents have written a whole bunch of those $5,000, $10,000 checks, they want that return on investment.
Well, and that also makes those checks and their increasing cost makes it become an exclusive kind of activity, which we'll talk about more a little bit later, Tom. But, okay, so, like, total transparency, I'm getting up there in years. I graduated from high school in 1993, so just before this sort of the shift as you're talking about. And you know, in the town that I grew up in, like, lots of kids played sports. I can't think of maybe like one or two kind of were specialized at that time. But the thing is that the community was really involved. There was a lot of fields to play on. There were a lot of sort of local rec leagues. If people wanted to play in high school, they could. Is there less of that, like, community sources of athletic play now that these, you know, basically the private sector, the private youth sports sector has stepped into?
Yes, there is less of it. The pathway now is kids slip on. Look, when I was a kid, I'm a little bit older than you. When I was a kid, I slipped on a uniform when I was probably 8 years old for the first time. Mm-hmm. You know, by the time my kids came along, it was 5 years old. You know, now it's when kids are 3 years old. Ah. And the travel teams, these select travel teams, begin to form when kids are 6 and 7 and 8 years old. And at that point, Mecca, that's when you start to see the dissolution of these in-town recreation leagues, these in-city leagues. They lose bodies, they lose coaches, they lose energy. And then the money from these private clubs that are at the center of the travel team experience, they're just more entrepreneurial and they grab the public, you know, the fields and the gyms, and they come to dominate the environment. So yeah, there are, and I'd love to kind of at some point talk about some of the solutions. There are communities that are pushing back on this and doing some good things. I do not think this is the end of the game. I think we can right size it, but yeah, right now the trend is, toward travel and, you know, not in city leagues.
I promise you we will talk about solutions in the last third of the show because we love solutions around here. But Tom, we just got 30 seconds before our next break then. Do you see any sign of this, the sports business, of its growth abating in the near future?
No, I don't. In part because there have been so many communities now that are invested in these mega facilities that are designed for tournaments, like large tournaments. So there's a lot of incentives to keep that part of the economy, the youth sports economy, going.
Oh, because it's now part of the community's economy. That is fascinating. Okay, Tom Ferry is author of Game On, The All-American Race to Make Champions of Our Children. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the commercialization of youth sports and what that's brought to families, the positive things it's brought to families, but also the considerable costs that it has brought to families, not just financial, but even costs on their kids. We're joined today by Tom Ferry. He's the executive director of the Aspen Institute Sports and Society Program. He's founder of Project Play and author of Game On, The All-American Race to Make Champions of Our Children. And again, Tom, as I mentioned earlier, we got a lot of listener response to this hour. I just want to hear from a couple more folks. Reedy Durst is from Santa Cruz, California, and she says the pressure for kids to specialize is leading to injuries. This is something that's been studied for the past couple of years, and it just keeps going. Reedy's daughter tore her ACL in her knee at age 14, which required the better part of a year for recovery.
It definitely was shocking. I think she dealt with it well. But when you have that kind of pressure on you at age 14, or this is your one activity that you think will take you far, it can really be devastating.
Here's Kyle Weber, an orthopedic physical therapist and former Division I college athlete. He left this message with his perspective.
There's solid research showing the risk of injuries and burnout increases significantly in single sport athletes. I think we just need to encourage our kids to be athletic rather than sports specific at young ages. And when they get old enough, they can be the ones to choose their own paths.
Tom, let me just quickly ask you, what is that evidence about burnout and injury? Has it been growing over time with single sport youth athletes?
Yeah, it has. And the injury rates have gone up significantly. You know, we created something called the National ACL Injury Coalition last year because ACL injuries have gone up 26% over the past decade. Sports like girls lacrosse, girls soccer, football. My son Meghna has had blew his ACL on the same knee three times by the age of 19.
Wow!
And these are not stories that are getting written about. And you know, now when I play Kellen, you know, I was in Colorado last week, and I'm like, hey, let's go skiing and snowboarding, but I caught myself because he can't do that anymore. He's technically retired from cutting and pivoting sports. And that makes me extremely sad. And there are a lot of kids who are facing that kind of fate, sadly. So yeah, we are burning out kids and we are breaking their bodies. And it just, we need to start caring about this.
You've got some data on the average age that a kid would quit can quit a sport now, or not can, but does quit a sport now.
Yeah. So our research shows that the average age at which a child quits a sport is 11 now. So by 11, they are deciding to check out, or they are being told that you're not good enough to, play on this this travel team, or you're from a family that just simply can't afford the cost of a sustained experience.
So the very age that kids used to start sort of getting more serious about sports is now the age where many of them have to exit it.
Yeah, retire from sports. They retire from sports at age 11. Before they've grown into their bodies, their minds, and their interests. And that's the fundamental flaw in our sports system, Magna, is that we are pushing aside kids well before they've even hit puberty. And we're deciding who's an athlete, or asking them if they are athletes, and they check out, or we lock them out of an experience.
Wow. I think the most heartbreaking part for me is that, does it also just have an impact on how they see athletics and sports for the rest of their lives? Like, has it kind of killed the joy of it for them?
I think so. And we can see that in, one of the big trends we've had, or one of the big developments over the past 20 or 30 years, is physical education in schools has diminished.
It's drastically,
drastically. And one of the reasons it has fallen off is because some people are like, well, they didn't have a great experience with PE and sports at an early age. And they're not necessarily going to advocate for it. They don't see it as like central to whole child education. And it is. It is a good sport experience, a balanced sport experience with a child's needs at the center is really catalytic. All the research suggests how beneficial it is in terms of, obesity reduction, chronic disease reduction, 13 types of cancer, educational achievement, on and on and on. But when you don't have good experiences, or you're shut out when you're young, it's hard for you to advocate for sport physical activity when you get older.
Oh, I see. You know, like did I enjoy not being able to get 2 or 3 feet off the ground in the rope climb when I was in fifth grade? No, I did not. But on the other hand, we did a lot of other things in PE too. And I'm old enough that it was actually every single day in my elementary school, which is pretty rare these days. But so, Tom, again, I want to get sort of the nuances and complexities of the parental perspective in here. So let's listen to a moment to Sarah Lawrence. She's a mom of four in Peters Township, Pennsylvania, and she is very much a sports person. In high school, it was volleyball, basketball, and lacrosse. She got a scholarship to play lacrosse in college, and since then, she's become a marathon runner and a coach in multiple sports. So yeah, she is very much a sports person, but crucially, not a single sport person, because Sarah believes the main benefits of sports for kids has really nothing to do with elite achievement.
Sports are wonderful for so many reasons, and it's not just to keep a kid active. You have to face conflict, and you have to deal with situations you're not comfortable knowing that you're going to make a mistake, and yet you still have to do it. So what I would hope my kids would see out of sports is that their hard work pays off, that their work ethic is a great lesson to learn at a young age, and that they can have confidence in themselves.
Sarah has introduced her kids to a wide variety of sports, but she says she's careful not to push them too hard to any one in particular.
Soccer was one of the first things we could sign up for in our township age-wise. So they've all done soccer, we've done baseball, we've tried swimming, we've done dance, we've done karate, we've done track and field. They've even done a lacrosse camp that was only like a couple weeks long, but just to get introduced to a sport, they did kind of everything.
So here's the thing. Sarah is very much conscientiously trying to avoid that early specialization path for her kids. And so her kids are not getting pressure from their parents specifically, but they are feeling some pressure from other kids at school. Soon after her son started playing in a more competitive soccer league, he got frustrated.
And one of the practices, he came home. He seemed frustrated. I was like, well, Benny, what's wrong? And we were talking. He's like, I just haven't picked my sport yet. I don't have one. He was in second grade. And I was like, you don't need a sport. You're in second grade. And he felt the pressure that, and he can see the kids that are on the numerous teams. And they are improving. They're doing great. They're learning a ton. But for our family, that's not the avenue we chose to take. And he could tell the difference and felt that at the age of, he may have been eight at the time, that he didn't have his sport.
So that's Sarah Lawrence, mom of four in Peters Township, Pennsylvania. And Tom, I want to just take a quick second to hear your thoughts on this, because what Sarah is saying, I've seen with my own eyes that the kids who do specialize early, play on those travel teams, and actually are quite good, let's admit, they're quite good at their sports. When it comes to school time play, things get exclusive, you know, on the playground. And there turns out to be this culture of, well, if you didn't start at the age of four or five, then you can't even play with us during recess. So is the whole culture amongst kids themselves shifting when it comes to, you know, what we think about as play?
Well, kids, like parents, are just responding to a sports system that I would argue is dysfunctional at best and broken at worst. You know, parents love their kids. They want to have them have opportunity, as they want to see them have a chance to play in high school. And you know, and they look around and all the kids who are getting playing time were doing private clubs from a pretty early age. So they just kind of go with it. And then you have kids who, because those kids are going with it. Yeah. Other kids at 8, 9, and 10 are like, well, maybe I'm just not good enough. I'm not an athlete. Maybe I'm not an athletic or even a physical person. Then they begin to check out. It's really a systems failure. We have a youth sport. This is the classic environment that is programs rich, but systems poor.
Uh-huh.
There is evidence about what good athletic development looks like, you know, from 0 to 6, 6 to 9, 9 to 12, et cetera. There's something called the American Development Model, which was pioneered by USA Hockey and by the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, but it just hasn't really taken, because there haven't been, we haven't just put policies that have kind of enforced age-appropriate play. Child development, we know what good child development looks like, but these ideas have not been baked into the system itself. And so
sorry to interrupt, but it sounds like it's because the system as it is now wouldn't profit from incorporating those ideas.
Exactly. If you can convince parents that if your kid plays one sport year round, starting at 8 or 9 years old, because that will position them best to get looks from college scouts when they're 15, 16, 17 years old, they're going to go with it. Even if these coaches and program operators know that's not really what the research says. The research usually tells you that multi-sport play, all-around athleticism, physical literacy, and love of game are what are most catalytic.
Mm.
That's what creates an elite athlete. But that's not, you know, in the interest of private operators who have mortgages to pay 12 months a year.
Well, and, you know, just to underscore what you're saying, we're dealing with growing bodies, right? Like physically growing minds and souls and physically growing bodies. So we spoke with Dr. Oluwatuyosi Owaye, who directs the Translational Sports Injury Prevention Lab at St. Louis University. And he said it's okay if kids have a primary sport. His own son focuses on basketball, but he also encourages his son's interest in other activities, and that balance is what helps prevent overuse injuries in growing athletes.
Make sure they do other sports. So my boy does swimming on the side, even though his primary sport is basketball. So just think about the things that would help offload the stress on the body, in terms of if he's doing a lot of jumping in basketball, for instance, I want him to go into the pool and swim to improve his cardiorespiratory endurance level. I want him to go into the pool and improve on his flexibility and, you know, get some relaxation and get some recovery time.
Okay, we also spoke with journalist and researcher Linda Flanagan, author of Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. And Tom, she echoed the point you made about those mega facilities. And she says that the money that's flooded youth sports can be traced back to a decades-long decline in funding for local parks and rec department. And the private sector, in a big way, has stepped in to fill that gap.
One of the key developments that shifted sports from local and low-cost to travel-oriented and expensive was the building of the Disney's Wide World of Sports complex in 1997, which is this massive church to sports. And Disney built this in order to attract families who had teenagers because those kids were no longer interested in Epcot and the Magic Kingdom. And so this was a very deliberate strategy to attract the teenage population. It proved to be massively successful, and other communities picked up on this. Since 1997, there's been a tenfold increase in the number of these complexes. There's now some 30,000 sports complexes around the country.
Wow. So, Tom, it's solutions time. We've got about three minutes left. And I know you've got some, at least a couple of good examples of ways to make sports more welcoming for kids, regardless of their skill, to maybe, not specialize as strongly. What should we try to do?
I mean, the first thing that parents can do is just have a conversation with your kid. Ask them, what they want to play, why they're playing, what success looks like for them. I mean, believe it, parents don't actually have these conversations with kids, So it starts there. It starts there. And then it's a matter of asking your local sport provider, okay, are your coaches trained in key competencies in working with kids? Do they have the basic safety stuff, CPR, first aid, but also just like general coaching philosophy, injury prevention, things like this? So parents need to be better advocates for their child and search for the better programs. But we also just need to organize our system better. Mm-hmm. We need better policy at the federal level, the state level, the local level. It is we just haven't created there's something called the Fairfax County Athletic Council, which we're going to be writing about real soon here. It's been around for 30 years and has representatives from each of the 8 big sports plus park and recs plus schools. And these people come together every month. And they report up to the county executive, and they figure out field use issues, and they advocated for the Children's Bill of Rights in sports, which is something we created, recently. They're able to create something of a collective voice to pull for what good looks like in youth sports in your community. So I think we need to organize the environment better, and then we need to invest in the stuff that we know works, right? So like Cambridge Youth Soccer Association over the past decade has tripled registrations at a time when soccer registration has been flat. And they've done that through not one single thing, but a series of measures, most significantly, revitalizing their in-town rec league through eighth grade by asking kids to play both travel and rec and finding a league for travel that doesn't conflict with the schedules, et cetera. So, it's investing in facilities, and Minnesota has invested in hockey rinks all over the state, and participation is doing better than any other state out there. And they're producing more talent at the highest level as well. So there are solutions. I would encourage people to be optimistic, explore them. A bunch of these resources on our website, they're all free. So hopefully it's useful.
Yeah, no, it's actually really useful. And we'll put a link to your website on ours, onpointradio.org. But what I'm hearing you clearly say is actually a lot of change can happen at the local level if local municipalities do what they can to revitalize their rec league. So kids who don't necessarily want to be an Olympian but love a sport can have high quality play that doesn't necessarily, it's not focused on elite play. I mean, I think that's a huge just mindset shift amongst towns. So Tom Ferry, author of Game On, The All-American Race to Make Champions of Our Children, thanks so much for joining us today, Tom.
Thanks, Meghna. Great to be here.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.